This is the Beat Your Genes podcast. My name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Ha, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during a show and ask a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or you can send us a question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you both doing this evening?
Very well.
How's it going?
I'm doing great. California apparently has entered phase three, which is we're getting closer to normal, and barbershops, hair salons, as long as they follow the guidelines, are starting to open back up. And there have been a few posts on the Facebook group, the fans of Beat Your Genes podcast group, just detailing the new data that's known. And Dr. Lyle, I think you're way too humble to do a mic drop, but if you did, I think I would laugh.
Yeah.
I would like it.
Someone needs to create that GIF.
So, I think things are looking pretty good.
Talking to you, Warren.
It's looking like it's going to basically tail off here at the end of May, which is what we're thinking. And, you know, hats off to the guys up there at the University of Washington. It looks like their early projections of the early projections of 93,000. I think that was the first thing that I had read is turning out to be just, you know, super accurate. So it's good to see that around the world, you know, basically everything is quieted down and gone through its, you know, in 8 to 10 week cycle. So they're pretty well all done in Italy and in Spain. And also I'm sure the UK is getting close. So, and America will drag on because of our bigger size. And so we'll sort of peter our way out here, but hey, you know what? It's storm's over and now it's just a little drizzle here from here. And then we've got some, work sort of to do, putting the economy back together in a smart way, but hey, fabulous. It's almost over. it's like your last final exam. It's like one more to go. And then we're done, and so we're in good shape. And then we get all the geniuses around the world feverishly working for the next 6 months to try to both figure out how to treat it better and obviously work on a vaccine. And so you know, maybe we get a big break or maybe we don't. But even if we don't get a big break, I have confidence in, you know, human ingenuity to chip away at even extremely difficult problems, and chipping away, this thing will not be anything close to the monster next year that it was this year. So, you know, I think we've weathered it, and if all of you and yours are alive and well, then, you know, got through. All good.
Yeah, and speaking of geniuses, there must be some out there talking about how to prevent a pandemic.
Yeah, do we know anybody that's writing a book on that?
I don't know. What do you think, Dr. Hawk?
Like, I feel like there's a brilliant book that just came out on this today. Was that? Yeah. So we're recording this. We're pre-recording this for the show on Wednesday. So today is Tuesday, May 26th. And our good friend, Dr. Michael Greger, just released a new book called How to Survive a Pandemic. Yeah, so it's talking about all of all of the specifics about COVID-19. So a lot of people who are listening to this podcast may not be familiar with him and sort of his place in the general plant-based movement. But he runs a nonprofit website called nutritionfacts.org, which is the source of evidence-based nutrition of information on all kinds of topics. New videos every day, and all of the proceeds going to charity. So it's an amazing resource for people who are interested in nutrition issues. But his background is actually in infectious disease before he moved over to lifestyle medicine. So he had written this book years ago, had started this research and couldn't find a willing audience for it. And so sort of moved into the chronic lifestyle disease space. But is obviously all of this information and all of the work that he had done and all of the knowledge that he had is finding new relevance now that we're facing all of this. So it's an amazing book, just came out and deals with what Nate's talking about, which is, I think one of the things that he's been saying as he's been talking about it is the best way to survive a pandemic is to prevent it from occurring in the first place. So, and I am not...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. You still need to buy the book, guys. But it's a very kind of common sense approach that is the best way to survive it. And I am not as much as I share a lot of Doug's optimism about sort of where this particular situation is heading, as far as the raw numbers of it go, I think that the dealing with the actual conditions that made it possible and likely and even inevitable is not something that we've really grappled with meaningfully, and specifically the relationship that we have as a civilization with the animals that we raise for food, because these are all pandemics are all linked to our relationships with animals and animal agriculture, and in this case wet markets and all of the other things that we've sort of touched on and talked about, but the book really gets into the history of that, and how all of the major pandemics of the last many centuries have been zoonotic and linked to our behavior and our interactions with animals. And then on the effect side, the sort of that's also another question that we haven't really grappled with, where we sort of talk about, okay, well, yeah, people, COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting people with pre-existing conditions, comorbidities, who are sort of vulnerable to it because of poor health. But why is that? Why are we dealing with such poor health outcomes at the population level? And all of those pre-existing conditions that make people more vulnerable to some sort of disease like this also happen to be most immediately addressed by a plant-based diet. So it covers a lot of ground. So we just happen to know of this resource that is available to people should they be interested in learning more about this topic.
Yeah, it's coming from... If people don't know Dr. Greger, well, first of all, anybody that has ever heard him speak, you'd never forget it. He's utterly unique as a speaker, and outstanding, by the way. But at any rate, of those of you who don't, it's entertaining. There's nobody like him. So very cool. I'm looking forward to reading this book.
And I am too. And it's Dr. Lyle. So this also has to do with the book that you wrote, The Pleasure Trap.
Sure.
As far as the addictive properties. So this goes into our first question of the show. It has to do with this, which... dear Dr. Lyle and dear Dr. Hawk, I love this podcast. Had to get that out first. I just have a few questions that would be very helpful if I could get an answer. So my question is, how does withdrawal and tolerance in drug usage compare to eating foods with addictive properties in terms of trying to quit? For instance, would planning a strict day and time for a specific portioned healthy meal once a week, then after get straight back on the wagon, aid in keeping tolerance low and cravings at bay? Or is complete abstinence the key to lifelong success in ending the addiction? The reason this listener is asking is because, quote, I've been trying for about 3 years to be whole food plant-based, but I've never made it more than 30 days. And when I cave into crap foods, each time it's making me doubt that I could ever achieve this success.
Yeah, I can start with that, Doug, if you want to jump in. But I've thought a lot about this question because I've sort of done my time with alcohol addiction as well as some time in the pleasure trap, as most of us have. So I have personal experience, and then also just talking to clients and thinking about this a lot. So the thing to kind of think about when you're looking at an addictive or a so-called addictive relationship with food is that the continuum of addictive substances starts at the point at which any substance starts to become something that you wouldn't have been able to encounter in the Stone Age. There was no addictive substance of any type in the Stone Age other than an occasional pile of fermented fruit that you might stumble into or something very short term. But there wasn't, you know, there wasn't alcohol, there weren't cigarettes, and there certainly wasn't processed food. So everything, if you're going to draw a line of, you know, mildly addictive like properties that some food will begin to have when you start to process it, all the way up the chain to cigarettes, or, you know, even before you get to cigarettes, something like coffee, and then cigarettes and alcohol, and continuing up to cocaine and to heroin and to meth, you're moving up this chain of substances that are becoming increasingly sort of unnatural and non-Stone Age congruent, and therefore having more potential addictive properties. And so if you have a relationship with food that you're thinking of as addictive, it means that they're in your diet, you have food that is not food that you would have had access to or gotten yourself into in the Stone Age. That's just the baseline. So if you lived in a context on an island where you didn't have access to any kind of supernormal food of any kind, and that would include some of the very low grade supernormal food that we will try to stay away from at True North, and that Chef AJ recommends, and certainly that Nate recommends at the Fasting Escape, which is, you know, even including like flour products, any kind of salt, oil, sugar, anything like that that's making the food more palatable and more processed. That is something that you wouldn't have had around in the Stone Age. And if you were on this magical island where all you had was absolutely whole plant food, you wouldn't eat addictively. You would just eat to satiety and you would be done. And even if you were having a really stressful day and you ate extra papaya that day, you wouldn't be suffering any kind of health consequences, or you wouldn't be at all overweight, because you wouldn't get into this thing that we start calling an addictive relationship to food. So it's all a continuum, and it's all individual to your particular nervous system and what you're most susceptible to. And you know, some people, there's sort of this idea that people will jump from addiction to addiction, and I sort of see that implied by this question a little bit. So, you know, if you quit alcohol, then you're going to replace it with food or with coffee, or if you quit smoking weed, you're going to start drinking more alcohol. It doesn't really work like that. They're not, addictions don't substitute for each other like that. They're all very specific to the individual. So you can have somebody who is very genetically predisposed to alcoholism but tries cocaine and it does nothing for them, or vice versa. So that happens all the time. And the same thing is going to be true with food, where some people are just, they're a little more hair triggery around foods that are slightly processed and slightly supernormal. So some people can get away with it and have a little bit in their diet and be able to stick to a mostly very healthy diet the rest of the time. And that little bit of supernormal food doesn't send them down the addictive rabbit hole like it will for somebody else who has one little taste of supernormal food and that's it. They're gone. They kick over the table. There's a phrase in 12-step called you get a case of the effets. You know, you're just like, no, I don't, screw it, I don't care about it anymore. I'm gonna lean into my addiction and it's all over. So this is a very, very individual process. So there's no specific answer to whether complete abstinence is what you need to stay compliant or not. But I'm suspecting most of the time when I talk to people, and certainly in my own experience, you're not being purely compliant on completely whole natural food for that 30 days before you're caving, as you put it. So there's something in there that's keeping that little addictive circuit alive, and it's causing you a lot of stress and making that decision over and over and over again, multiple times a day, to do the right thing. So you just, your success here depends on limiting the amount of times per day that you're requiring yourself to call upon your willpower to make the right decision. So that's why we talk so relentlessly about getting the environment right. You don't want to be putting yourself in that decision, in that place where you have to make that decision. You want it to be a non-decision. You want to create the island with the magical Stone Age food as much as possible. And if you do that for 30 days, you're going to find most likely that the cravings, the addictive patterns are going to get so quieted down that you're not walking that line where you're feeling like you're on the brink of a relapse all the time, like you will feel if you're keeping the little addictive flame alive with slightly supernormal food. And so I understand that that's really hard to do if you're living a normal life in a normal household, sharing it with other people, and you don't have total control of your environment, which is why we always kind of joke, not joke, that one of the best things that you can do for yourself is to check yourself into jail. So you've got to break the process. Like Nate is chuckling as the warden of his own prison system. but this is really important, because you're also probably in a set of circumstances that we call a conditioned cram circuit to some degree, where you're not only getting yourself into food that is super normal by Stone Age standards, but you've conditioned the process. So you've like enabled the little addictive process by consistently linking a super normal food to a certain time of day, a certain set of rituals and patterns.
Or when the podcast finishes recording.
When the podcast finishes, you go get your vegan pizza or your udon, Nate. So totally, this is, and we've talked about that before, so I won't totally belabor the notion, because I don't want to spend the entire podcast on this, but it is, you always be aware that you're completely capable of setting up this little conditioning loop, this little, you know, oh, well, this thing, these are all the little cues that I'm perceiving that happen at the same time every day, and this is the time that I get into some sort of supernormal stimuli that I am not adapted to be able to handle. And for some people, it's completely unfair, but that can be almond butter on Ezekiel bread, or it can be, you know, udon noodle soup or something that is just slightly over processed, that's going to keep you in this little raggedy, addictive like place where it makes doing battle with this so much harder than it has to be. If you, like, once you have gotten yourself fully free of whatever that threshold is for you, and you were in a relationship with food where you were not getting into anything that is approaching super normal, it's a very freeing place to be, because the nervous system finally gives up the fight, or largely gives up the fight, and you're not doing battle with your willpower constantly like you are when you're in that initial withdrawal phase. So it's a gift that you should give yourself at least once if you're in a calibration process and trying to experiment with this. And it may be the case that you have to completely get yourself out of your food environment and check yourself into jail at the Fasting Escape or at True North if you can get past the wait list or somewhere like that, to just give yourself that chance to really reset the whole system and understand what it feels like to get out of a super normal relationship with food.
Wonderful.
Fabulous. Yeah. Right on.
Thank you for that answer, Dr. Hawk.
Yeah.
Go to jail.
Go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I wondered how famous you would be. It occurred to me. I wondered how famous you'd be if instead of calling it Fasting Escape, you'd call it the fasting jail, fasting prison. Just like that.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah, it gets you that notoriety.
Have a big sign outside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the logo would have bars, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
With a little street urchin. Well, please, sir.
Please, sir. Just, may I have another?
Just a bit of gruel.
Well, I do say that the Fasting Escape, when people finish the program, they graduate and we call them the Fasting Escapees.
Yes.
Which is adorable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's good, but Yashi, when they come, they should have to wear, you know, striped shirts.
There you go. This is a whole
I do sometimes have to spackle the wall. I do have to sometimes spackle the wall next to the headboard as I scratch the number of nights they've been here.
That's really good. All right. Very good. All right. What else do we have?
Well, our next question.
Yeah.
All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, it seems so far that calorie restriction might not offer the degree of increased longevity benefits for humans as is found in mice and other animals. If you took an evolutionary perspective on this, what might you guess could explain why humans don't get quite the boost that other animals do? Do you think humans and perhaps some other animals, I don't know, say polar bears who sometimes go a very long time between meals, do you think they have the physiology that might expect to go hungry fairly often? So it's required for a normal lifespan rather than causing an abnormally longer one.
I'll talk about that one.
Yeah.
This is a calorie restriction and longevity was, you know, sort of a fascinating discovery. I don't know who first did it. It was probably 40 years ago. And it fired up an awful lot of speculation. And so before enough was known about it, of course, we had a few wackos that decided they were going to do it. So just to explain to people that don't know about this, caloric restriction was the finding that if you would take rats, for example, and let them eat healthy rat chow at libitum, i.e. as much as they want, they're at a certain weight and they'll live a certain lifespan. But if you knock that down to, I think it was something like 70% of that level of caloric intake, mm-hmm. they will live, you know, 50 to 100% longer. So I think lifespans might typically extend by 50% or so. And so you can, and it was actually discovered that this would be true in essentially every species that had been looked at, like 33 species, something like that. So this, of course, you could look at this and you had some bright, crazy people that decided, you know, by 1980 that they'd seen enough and they were going to do it. And so they did. So you got some of these people walking around and they're determined. They're down there eating, you know, 70% of normal calories. The way you can usually do that and not go absolutely crazy is to eat all raw. If you're just eating a great deal of raw food that's low calorie density raw food, you just basically stuff the gut with copious amounts of low calorie density food, and that way you don't go crazy because you're constantly activating stretch receptors in the stomach saying that you're okay, even though the system knows it's on the brink of starvation. Now, it's going to turn out some interesting things happen when you do this. And the first thing of interest is you don't live any longer. So that's the bad news, okay? Womp, womp. So the question is, why? Okay, so, well, we could talk just a little bit. It turns out that part of the effect of so-called calorie restriction lengthening life has to do with the fact that even with original rat studies, they weren't necessarily feeding them whole natural rat food. And they're eating processed rat chow. And as a result of that, the rats would have some percentages of obesity, hypertension, diabetes, etc. And so it turns out that part of the effect we were seeing was that in original studies, sometimes those animals were being slightly systematically overfed by an unnatural diet. So obviously, if you're being systematically overfed by a little bit, then if you cut the calories and you have a rat not eating as much as it wants, you're not really at 70% of ad libitum eating. You're probably at 80% or 90%. So you're not stressing the system as much as you think you are, and you're actually reducing the likelihood of diseases of dietary excess, which is a chief, you know, reason why animals and people die a little bit earlier than they would need to. Now, it's going to turn out that for humans are eating way on average more than they should. So as a result, if you were to take a typical diet and you were to actually have people eat an appropriate amount of calories with that diet, they'd be in semi-starvation mode psychologically. In other words, they wouldn't be very satisfied at all, just because there's not enough stretch reception with such concentrated food, and so they'd be gnawing at their knuckles. But they would be appropriate normal weight is what would happen. And so with that reduction in food intake, you would see an increase in lifespan because you'd have a reduction of diseases of dietary excess. So it wouldn't be as good as a whole natural foods diet because you'd still have some heart disease because people would be eating a lot of animal food and some other things. But they wouldn't be eating it in the amounts. So now we're going to walk our way to, okay, what on earth is the life expectancy effect? Why does it exist? And why can't we replicate it in human life? Well, I'm pretty sure we could. But it turns out that the effect is actually caused by, in certain species, maybe humans, maybe not. It may not be a genetic characteristic of humans, but it probably is. And that is that if you restrict calories indefinitely from inception, from early childhood, what's going to happen is you will stop the progression of its maturity into a sexually reproducing organism. So you can essentially keep it in a state of suspended animation. And if you do that, so that's what's going on with these other species. So if you take a rat at birth and you let it only eat 70% of what it wants to eat, what it will do is it will not become a sexually mature adult. And by doing that, there's things that take place when you become mature that there's just a bunch of machinery that has to get brought online, and then you go through a process, a life cycle process. Strangely enough, in many organisms, if you frustrate that process, the organism has the capability somehow of sort of being in this netherland state, it's almost like it's waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting to put its foot on the gas until it finally gets enough food where it could then finally become a sexually mature organism and then do what it was designed to do, which is to find sex, romance, love, and whatever else there is. Okay. So
acai bowls.
Acai, that's right. So it turns out that we don't know whether or not this would work in humans, but of course it would be utterly unethical and absurd to ever try. They may be able to figure out, I think that you'll see characteristics of this, for example, in anorexic girls, where if they are consistently anorexic, you know, starting at age 10 or 11, I think you can see essentially what you call youthful cues that can be extended. I think that's correct. And so you're seeing evidence of that. They probably won't restrict for long enough through the entire lifespan to keep themselves in suspended animation and extend their life. I don't think it probably would work. Or if it does, it would probably be a very small effect. And also, there's going to be deleterious effects as a result of semi-starvation, malnutrition, etc. So is it possible? Yes. Is it worth anything? No, it's an utterly worthless idea. And so I was actually kind of relieved to find this out. I think it was in the 1990s when this became evident. And so because I had been worried, like, you know, Doug, if you had any guts, you ought to be doing this. And just thinking like, hey, if I did this, you know, God, there might be 40 or 50 years on the table. You know, should this be worth doing? And the answer is no. And you don't see any place on earth where people have been struggling on the edge for calories and eating, you know, essentially underneath what their hunger drive is, and that they live significantly longer than anybody else. They don't. So there's no evidence that if you get enough food to get to sexual maturity, that there's any extra lifespan getting tacked off at the end. So no, enjoy your whole natural foods. Don't be systematically overweight by eating foods that are overly rich, and you know, enjoy the party, because we only get so much of it and it's done.
That's it.
What? Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Lyle, for clarifying. All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, we became a big fan of you all during lockdown. I also recently celebrated my 30th birthday during this time. As fun and different as it was, the classic questions have now come to mind about dating and settling down. I'm single, have not been on a date in 2 years. I know my chances are decreasing by the year of, quote, finding a mate. And I am worried that males will be able to tell that I'm not as young as is ideal. Is there any way of avoiding this or giving off the illusions or impression that I still have value on the market as much as a 20-something year old?
This question upsets me.
I'm not touching this thing.
Yeah.
Where's my toxic masculinity alarm when I need it? No, I mean, I'm genuinely upset by this question, because it's coming from a very authentic place, and I completely understand what she's asking and why she's asking it, and it's rooted in very real mate value algorithms that we have talked about, you know, ad nauseum on the show. And I just, but I feel that it's, the sort of framing this is like, how can I give off the illusion or the impression that I still have value on the market as much as a younger woman? This is not what the enterprise that you should be engaged in. This is not the way to think about this. You all things equal from a Stone Age perspective, you know, putting on our little evolutionary psychology hats here, you do have less objective mate value than someone who has more fertility capacity and is giving off more fertility cues. So that is the sort of overarching thing that is driving this question, and I completely appreciate that and understand why a young woman would want to kind of hack that situation. And of course, that's what the entire beauty industry is. That's what women are constantly doing. And I am not trying to suggest that there's not a really important and worthwhile logic behind that, and that it's the question's out of bounds at all. But it's I want to try to steer you away from this kind of all-encompassing qualification anxiety. This kind of idea that that you were in a position where you have to relentlessly market yourself to the exclusion of enjoying your life. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't be doing your best to market yourself for the best possible mate that you can find, because you should be, both because that's a big thing that you're looking at turning 30, especially if you want to have kids. This is an important goal for you. But also that is going to be the process by which you're going to derive a lot of important self-esteem processes. So getting yourself in the best shape that you can get in, and looking the best that you can look, and putting yourself out there as the best representative of who it is that you are, and representing yourself to the Stone Age Village as the sum total of everything that you have to offer. Those are all important and worthwhile and valid things to be doing. And you want to be doing all of that to the best of your abilities, because that is the way to secure the best mate that is out there for you. And it's also the way to feel as good about yourself as you were able to feel, and to drive the pride and the enjoyment of your achievement process that is going to contribute to meaningful self-esteem. But that's a very different kind of orientation to all of this than the way that this question is framed, which is something that I hear a lot, and particularly women who are kind of adjacent to this EP world start thinking in this way, in a way that is really detracting from their enjoyment of their own life and their own life experience, because they're completely oriented toward this toward this problem and toward this anxiety that they're losing by the day. I mean, there's something in this question about how your chances are decreasing by the year. And that's a little bit of a self-defeating, somewhat tragic way to think about it. So it's, I just want to pivot you back toward living your life in a way where you're living it for yourself and you're qualifying for the best possible mate who is going to be over rewarded by you. And that's the nature of the game, no matter how this goes down. And so you want to be doing it in a way that is allowing you to enjoy the process rather than go through it in this state of intense self-loathing and worry that you're losing the game to younger women. So it's a little bit of a subtle distinction, but I think it's a really important one, and I think it's important for women to sort of grapple with who are would otherwise have a lot to learn from evolutionary psychology and a lot of different ways to optimize their life in general, but kind of run into this line of thinking around this particular problem and are really put off by it. So I consider it a bit of a personal mission to integrate the two. So that's my feminist rant for the night.
Good.
Mm-hmm. I'll go back in my corner and be quiet now.
Alarm?
Yeah. No, I'd like to add a little bit of a concept. And this is what I call the moving cohort. So you have to understand that as you age, your cohort that you're interested in is aging as well. And so if you're 30, you at 21, you really weren't interested. I mean, you weren't interested in, unlikely you were interested in a 40-year-old, and it's very unlikely a 40-year-old was interested in you. They might have been interested in looking at you, but they weren't really interested in you. When you're 30, you know, your market now is, who knows, 27 to 45. Okay, so that is a different, and as you age, when you're 35, your market is 32, if you're, I don't know, lucky and hot, 32 to, you know, 50 or 45 or whatever it is for you subjectively. So the point is that, you know, when you're 50, you are still absolutely in the game, but if you're a 50-year-old female, you're not in the game for a 32-year-old male. I mean, maybe you are if you're Joan Collins for a while, but the truth of the matter is that that's just not how life works. And you probably wouldn't be interested in a 32-year-old guy when you're 50. So this is the moving cohort. And so, you know, we all are worried intuitively about our competitive standing. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, well, what women want is blah, blah, blah these days. It's like, no, that just means that you're intimidated by the competitive problem and you're upset about it just like everybody else. And I have women say, well, what men want is this or that. Well, let's say, suppose you're a 45-year-old attractive female doing a good job trying to compete and you feel like, wait a minute, there's these 25-year-old women walking by. Wouldn't the guy prefer them? No. No, he wouldn't. So not your guy. He actually would not prefer that. And so that's a misunderstanding of the moving cohort, and so that's just how that works. And it is true that both males and females, males start losing their power, their generalized attractiveness as they turn 40. So get with it, Nate. Make hay while the sun shines. The point is that, you sort of, a male turning 40 is not dissimilar to a female turning 30. And so with that process, you know, the moving cohort starts to have increasing meaning for both, but in no way does it trap anybody into a situation where they can't compete. You're dealing with the same competitive parameters that you always had. And the 50-year-old male, honest to goodness, almost never would prefer a 25-year-old to a 40-year-old, very unlikely. Now, if you're 40, might he prefer 38? Yes, but that doesn't mean he gets it. So everybody's designed by nature to be essentially not excited about the job that would pay the most in their industry. They're excited about a really good job that they feel like is a great all-around deal, and it's the best deal they've seen in a long time, and they just think it's going to be a fantastic job. That's what a great mate is. A great mate isn't that this guy is saying, well, gee, you know, if you were 10 years younger, it'd be an even better deal. Well, theoretically, that may be true. But the truth of the matter is he's not even thinking that he would remotely qualify. Let's suppose a guy is 46. He's not thinking he's likely to qualify for somebody who's 32. If he does, it's some wingnut in all probability. So the truth of the matter is, what's his real market? His real market is closer to his own age. That's where, all things considered, that trade is going to work. So does he want as much youth and beauty as he can get? Yes, under conditions where all other things are being considered. So as Jen says, there's no reason to catastrophize ever about our own personal competitive situation. Do we have angst about it? Of course. Welcome to life. Welcome to running Jimmy's taco stand. Is Jimmy concerned about his competitive situation? Of course he is. We're all concerned about our relative competitive situation. The beauty of it is that we don't have to, you know, become the CEO of Taco Bell and own the world. We just have to run a good taco stand and be profitable. And that means being emotionally profitable, finding, competing for, earning, finding and winning a wonderful love relationship. And if we're lucky, we need one. And then we're in great shape.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Lyle, in all fairness, yeah, I have a pretty clean garage as of these days. So,
Nate has very.
Does that get me anything?
I would just throw into this too, and we've talked about this before, but this is you know, the kind of trap that this questioner is describing, mm-hmm, of, you know, giving off the impression that you're competitive with the 20 somethings. That is something that is going to be really reinforced by making like approaching the problem primarily through apps, and specifically, mm-hmm, the swipey apps.
Casual mating.
Yeah, because you're essentially participating in a casual mating derby without thinking that you are. You think that you're on there to find a pair bond, and you think that you're going to be able to fish a pair bond out of that ridiculous mess of casual, yeah, mating shenanigans. The incentives are such that, and we've talked about this before, and I have a video about this, but that women are... They're not understanding the moving cohort, and so they haven't recalibrated to that, and they're responding only to men that they're immediately very over rewarded by. So they're swiping through the app, and they're saying yes, oh, he's hot, yeah, I'd like that, and they're getting cues from the men who are participating in the apps that they would potentially qualify for Parabon because they're sleeping with the guys and they seem to qualify, and then they get confused when they get ghosted because they're bypassing the whole repeat exposure process that is so important to finding a really good solid pair bond where he's over rewarded and you are growing to admire his character and personality and stabilizing the connection through a more organic process. So it's if you're in the game where you're trying to like compete with 20-year-olds by getting the angle on your selfie just right on your Tinder app, that is the wrong game to be playing. Unless you're looking to casually mate, but it doesn't sound like you are from this question. It sounds like you're looking to find your life partner. So I would just recommend in that case that you go at least towards some sort of, if you're gonna do online dating, that you start your search with the websites that require some kind of male investment as part of the process. So they're paying, you know, some fee to Match or to eHarmony or to whatever, instead of just downloading a free app and swiping freely. So
excellent.
That's wonderful.
All right. One more in us or no?
Yes. Our next question just flows beautifully from Dr. Hawk's answer, which is following your lust just another pleasure trap that will leave you dissatisfied long term? We've talked about this on the show before. You've talked about this on the show before, Dr. Lyle, a few years ago about the vasopressin hormone. Mm-hmm. But this question asks, should a person who is not pair bond oriented try to work towards this for long-term happiness, or would it be akin to trying to change your personality?
Very fine question. I'm going to bet it came from a male. Just 90% chance.
Seems likely.
My answer would be I wouldn't be trying to change anything about my personality until I was discovering that I kept doing something repeatedly that was self-destructive. And casual mating strategy isn't self-destructive, in principle. So the answer would be no. And I think that my way of figuring out how to live this life is it's a process of discovering who it is that you are. You don't change that. It's a process of discovery. And so if this person is heavily casual mating strategy oriented, that is probably the way it is, except it those two strategies. First of all, it's overly simplistic to see them as two dichotomies. It's actually a continuum. And it's a continuum that is context dependent. So for example, let's take an average conscientious guy, average disagreeable, agreeable, average emotional stability, super handsome, smart. So, and has managed with that intelligence and other assets, and is good high income. So he's high income, super handsome. He's 35 years old, and he's intermediate level disagreeable. So he's reasonably agreeable, but he's reasonably disagreeable, and he's average conscientious. This guy is right in the kill zone for casual mating strategy. It's a perfect situation. Okay, now. Because he's not so conscientious
the kill zone, Doug.
Yeah.
I need to not leave you.
It's called making a kill. Right?
This is what happens when I leave you guys alone for a week.
I don't know. All right. So this guy's going to score a lot of points.
You were saying about the kill zone, Dr.
Lowe. Oh my god.
This guy's going to rack up a big score, okay? Now, so the thing is, though, that as life goes on, his context may change. So now he's 50 years old. He's not so screaming handsome. And so now he's having to do what, in order to get, for example, the same 10s that he was getting with these when he was 35, he now has to provision them more, and he has to actually make more signals that he may be pair bond interested. So we start to see the life of Warren Beatty, okay, who finally, quote, settled down at 60. Okay, so Warren Beatty, who was super wealthy, super talented, super ridiculous handsome. And so now anybody in this generation now that looks at him now says, what do you mean he's handsome? Well, you didn't see him, you know, in 1965 or 1975. The guy was ridiculous handsome. And so as a result, you know, he just had his way with the world as you would expect. But what happens is that finally his mate value slips, starts getting chiseled down that little half a percent a year between his 40th birthday and his 60th birthday. And so at some point he becomes a 9. And so to get a 10, he has to pair bond, which is exactly what he did. So this question is, my attitude is, be yourself and don't worry about it. As long as you're not getting your face gouged too much. Yeah. But the point is that, you know, life will give you different opportunities in different situations, and you'll learn. So I had a friend of mine like this. It's somebody that Jen and I both know, who was a very cool drummer, disagreeable, pushy, big, strong,
very
good-looking
pushy
guy. Okay. And this guy had his way, you know, around the country as traveling rock drummer.
Waste no opportunity to tell you.
That's a priceless comment. So, but at any rate, the point is at 38, he ran into Miss Wright. And that was that. It was done. He didn't even have any cognitive. Well, he did. He had cognitive dissonance for 2 weeks after he met her for 15 minutes. He went home, thought about it. In fact, he went up to the old True North Health Center, which was like a cheapo version of Fasting Escape. And he went up there and contemplated his future. And he thought, am I going to call this girl back or not? And he ran the CB in that 2 weeks. And he came back and decided, yeah, I'm going to do it. And his first date out with her, first real date, he took her home to meet his mother. He just knew. Aww. And so that's the story of one of my best friends. So that's an example of a guy who really thought that he would always be a casual mating player. He just didn't see how that... He had been a casual mating player from 16 to 38. And finally, one day, the circumstances, you know, presented him with a situation where suddenly he found his pair bond strategy. And so this individual, your pair bond strategy is within you. Whether or not you ever trip over it or not is unknown. But there's nothing in the world... This is... Casual mating strategy is not a pleasure trap. It's just it's an individual personality characteristic, being activated under certain conditions. So no worries, nothing to think about. Just, you know, be reasonably smart about it. That's all.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the question, if it did come from a female, the answer is a little different. We don't think that it did. But if this is a female, you know, if you're a female sort of like the earlier questioner who's sort of caught in a casual mating loop because that seems to be the demand of the market to remain competitive with the wrong cohort that you're competing with, that's a whole different set of problems.
Yes.
It depends a lot on what you're goals are and whether you do want a pair bond and or children, and so that's going to be a very individual process. But that would require a little more discernment on the part of a female if she's caught in that loop. But that's
sure.
a different question for another day.
You got it.
Well, we can't wait, Dr. Hawk. So
yes,
we will wait eagerly for that day.
Yes,
there's a little extra sarcasm.
Oh my!
All right,
all right.
Well, Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much for the great show. We will digest this and then look forward to coming back next week and ask you some more.
Fantastic.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thank you,
Nathan.
Thanks, Nate. Enjoy your udon.
Have a good night.
Gotcha.
It's all locked down, so that's broken my cycle very effectively.
All right.
See you
next
week.
Good
night.
Gotcha.
Good night.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.